Welcome to FinTech Chatting, presented by Tier 1 People, leaders in FinTech executive search. Follow us on your favorite podcast player or FinTech Chatter TV on YouTube.
And welcome to FinTech Chatter, the show for all things FinTech Down Under. I'm your host, Dexter Cousins, and today I've got two really cool guests with me from Scolari Partners, Giles Bourne and Jenny Lee. Giles, Jenny, welcome to FinTech Chatter.
Thanks for having us on your show.
Thank you.
Now, I've brought you on for a very specific reason. Probably the greatest challenge. I think it's almost a, you know, I think a kind of watershed moment for the fintech industry here in Oz. Is last quarter, the investment numbers were down 90% on the corresponding quarter of 2022. And we're kind of reaching crisis point for a lot of early stage businesses out there who need to secure funding in the next 12 months or get a path to profitability or cash flow positive in the next 12 months. I've got a long kind of relationship with Scolari. You're the standout kind of investment partners that I think, and you've got a really unique approach. So it's, you know, fantastic to have you on the show. But before we go into kind of the whole Scolari, setup, Jenny, Giles, Jenny, would you like to introduce yourself first and let us know a little bit about who you are and your background?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. My professional background is finance and commerce. I spent the last 15, 18 years working with early stage company, building the business, growing as well as exiting the business. I've done that a couple of times. I'm just really passionate about working with early stage founders and make their dreams come true. So I am a partner of Scolari Partners, also a member of IC, Investment Committee.
And a little birdie tells me that you get very excited by the word cash. Is this right?
I love cash. I think that is part of the key reasons why, you know, that's what makes the founder successful in what they do, right? But also cash runway turns out to be the number one critical factors and the number one reasons why early stage company can fail, despite the fact that they have awesome product and idea. So cash is critical for a company at that stage. And we work very closely with the companies to really be smart about how and when they spend their cash.
So Giles, we were introduced by James, who's a good friend of mine. I've known for a number of years, and you kind of founded Scolari with James. You want to tell us a little bit about you and your background?
Sure. So my name's Giles Bourne. I come from a commercialization of technology. So I've been in Australia for 25 years, having come from the UK, much like yourself, Dexter. You know, we saw the light and wanted a bit of sunshine and it brought us here, but very happy to be here. But I've been working in pretty much a fairly diverse range of technology companies, from software through to polymers and in semiconductors. But it's all about commercialization of emerging technologies. And I've absolutely love that space, always been involved in it. And that's the reason why we started Scolari, actually, 3.5 years ago, is because we saw an opportunity to invest in early stage tech, but not just invest, but really sort of help the founders in their scaling up journey. And that's always been a passion of mine since I've been here in Australia.
Now, obviously, the portfolio is a lot broader than fintech, but some of the notable names that I'm sure many of our listeners would know would be Frankie One, Cape, just a couple of the fintech investments that you've got. But do you want to tell us a little bit more about your kind of portfolio a little bit more broadly? And I think importantly, what you look for when you're looking at businesses to invest?
Sure. Well, so, I mean, look, we've got a fairly broad portfolio. I'll start off and perhaps Jenny, you can say a few words. But, you know, we've got 26 companies now in the portfolio, not all in Australia. We've got a couple in the UK. We've got the US, Singapore and Holland as well, but mostly here because that's where we're based for a good network across. But what we're looking for in the portfolio always is a founder who's got great passion. Obviously, the technology is fundamental, but someone who has got great passion for what they're doing, but realizing that they need not just capital, but they need help to grow their business. And that's where we can sort of use our expertise. Obviously, Jenny's had deep expertise in finance and working in the startup industry. James Walker, you mentioned earlier, and Nick Roberts have both been involved in early stage tech companies, scaling them up. So we can use that sort of expertise. You know, we've been through the rough and smooth and work with the founders to help them grow the business. And that's really, we're looking for founders who understand that they need more than just cash, but they need help to grow the business. And that's where we step in.
Jenny, from your side, what are the kind of things that you look for? You're CFO, so you're the kind of the cash, as you mentioned. What are the things that you look for in a not just in founders, but in a product as well, or an idea that gives you confidence that it's worth investing in?
Yeah, I think investors look for different things during different time. In this particular 18-24 month, I've been hearing a lot about client stickiness. So not too much about how aggressive, you know, your product or your revenue can grow, but in terms of your client loyalty, your retention rate, your ability to upsell. I've been hearing a lot about capital efficiency. So for example, if I invest a dollar today, you know, where do you deploy that to maximize the return? Probably for early stage company, particularly technology companies, we're looking at your development to income ratio, and also your acquisition, client acquisition cost. So a lot of those metrics that kind of talk to your capital efficiency, your net burn, your runway, your client retention and growth becomes a lot more common these days, and your path to profitability, which you mentioned before. Yeah.
So if I go back maybe 12, 18 months and I look at the briefs that I was working on, pretty much everyone had a mandate of go and find us somebody who's coming from Silicon Valley who can go and scale the business, you know, and kind of growth at all costs. And 6 months later, I was like, stop the search. All bets are off. You know, go and find us somebody who can manage a P&L, keep costs down and increase revenue. We've seen very quickly, not just here in Oz, but I think globally, the mindset shift from growth at all costs to cut costs at all costs. What have you found from, you know, just like within the portfolio and founders, has been the challenge for them to completely kind of reset that mindset and move more into that mindset around P&L management and just managing costs and kind of trying to, you know, scrimp and save?
Yeah, well, maybe I just kick that off, but just look, obviously, when we started Scolari, there was a lot of capital available, valuations were high. It's a very different environment today, you know. And so our message to our founders, as always, is, you know, managing their cash as best they can. You know, going out and doing capital raises is a lot more time-consuming, a lot more challenging than before. And when we started, you know, raising money, or sorry, investing in these companies, we would have a community that would come alongside us. They're much more risk-averse at the moment. They're cautious, although things are beginning to change, we see, slowly but surely. But so a message to the founders is always, you know, look at your cost base really closely, focus on growing your revenue line, your customers as much as you can, and try and manage that as best.
Jenny?
Yeah, I'd just like to add a few more points as well. I think, first of all, let's acknowledge it is actually very hard for founders to think or not to think growth, right? Because it is part of their instinct that I have a dream and I think this dream is big and I'm going to make it huge, right? So shifting that mindset, I think, well, first of all, it will come to that realization moment that it's just harder to find capital these days or takes longer. So I have to adjust my own expectation. But secondly, equally important, I think it's education. Be aware of what options are out there. So for example, for me to, you know, extend my runway or find a path to reach break even sooner, have we thought about profit sharing? Have we thought about ways to delay expenses? You know, for example, paying out ESOP rather than cash, or more of a commission scheme. So a lot of those alternative ways to run your business with that mindset to be more cost conscious comes with education. And that's where Scolari can play our active part, because we have resource hub there that show the founders these are the options that you can consider.
Maybe just to add to that also, I mean, one thing that we've started working very closely with is someone to help on the grant writing process. You know, there's a lot of good grants out there and a lot of good support, non-dilutive support for companies. And so that's become front and center of our advice to the companies, is sort of working on looking at both regional, state and federal grants that might be able to support it, any sort of non-dilutive funding that comes about.
You talked there about managing costs, and the biggest cost for any of these businesses is their people. One thing that's been really interesting from my perspective has been to see the shift in skills, experience, and outcomes that businesses are looking for from talent. So I mentioned before, you know, you're looking for the Silicon Valley unicorn. Now you're just looking for the person to manage the P&L. But we've also kind of had a lead up period where salaries went out of proportion. You know, we were seeing, you know, people with 2 years experience demanding 200K. it's obviously clearly unsustainable, and it's even more so now. Is there, a legitimate case to kind of be advising founders around headcount reductions, redundancies, or even looking at completely reskilling their teams to shift towards it looks like it's going to be a kind of longer term environment rather than a short dip?
Yeah, look, I'll just kick off with that and then Jenny can say a few words. But yeah, look, absolutely. So what we've done is we've got an HR service that we're sort of helping our portfolio companies
with. Interesting. Because look, what I don't want to be doing is advising people stuff that, legally then they get into water.
We're sort of trying to give them that advice. But the other thing we're trying to do, rather than sort of having the cost of having permanent sort of staff on your books, is provide a fractional service. So fractional CFO, CMO, sales, et cetera. So try and let manage their costs by pulling in the resources on a needs basis rather than having that cost the payroll.
I think one thing that COVID taught us is the way that we run our business these days is very different, right?
Yeah.
So there is the virtual environment. There is the, part-time contracting model out there. There's the offshore, right?
Yeah.
So I think, just jump out of that traditional thinking, that box, and understand what the options are. I'm just going to give one example. So one of our portfolio companies based in UK, it's a smart audio-based fitness app. So they're thinking of expanding their business into this side of the map. Next stop is probably Australia. So that migration usually costs a large amount of investment, right? So what Scolari can help is, we have people here helping to, fine tune their go-to-market strategy and have workshops with this company to kind of target their first, 10 customers in this. So let's set up the path and the foundation for them, including finance, corporate governance, and all of that is at probably not even 1/5 of the cost that usually the old model, you have to invest a lot in legal compliance and, go to market. So those are the examples that we see more and more often these days within our community as well as outside our community.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, with that particular example, we're rolling up our sleeves, helping with our sales, just helping them establish here in the country. And we've got the resources in the sort of Scolari team to help them do that, and keeps their costs down.
I want to double click on the fractional exec thing that you mentioned, because I'm critical of that kind of model, not because it doesn't work. I've been an advocate for it for many years. And indeed, when James was telling me about his vision around Scolari, I was like, yeah, brilliant idea. And the reason why is that James is probably one of the people that I would put as, how the fractional exec worked is it's pretty much impossible, unless you've got lots of experience at doing it, to be able to work fractionally for 3 or 4 startups and put the mental agility and the challenges that come with that. And the other thing that gets me is time. If you've got 4 clients, they all could have demands at the same time, and you can't just say, hey, well, I'm not rostered in to catch up until next month. So how do you make this kind of Scolari Partners model work so that the portfolio businesses are getting the right expertise at the right time and the very moment that they need it?
Well, maybe I sort of got to kick off with this one, Jenny. But look, for some work, it's fairly prescriptive. You're doing finance, preparing management accounts, doing all the finance activities is a certain amount of allocation of time per week. So people can do that, and it's you know what you're doing. For other services like sales, it's obviously a bit more fluid. It can be time consume 1 week and less time the next week. And so it's for us to try and manage that. So we're building teams to help drive that forward. I mean, some of the fractional work that we're doing at the moment is well and truly established and it's working really well.
Yeah.
And our clients get a really sort of, our portfolio companies get a really good use out of it. Other ones, we're still experimenting with it, but so far so good. But it's up to us to try and manage the time well.
And I think also we are the investor as well, right? So our interests are totally aligned. We are not just an external consultant, right?
Yeah.
So every month, I mean, our core team comes together and we talk about every single investee companies, what opportunities we see, what challenges they're trying to solve. So coming back to Giles' point about we have a team, I feel that our understanding about the business that we invest is 360 degrees. So we have 96 directors who, in contact with the business every day, week, month. And then we have consultants, advisors who really come in and solve real tangible problem. And then we also have a community behind which really review and listening to these companies and get their feedback. So I feel like the combination of this makes our model successful. Yeah. And that's what we feel proud of.
But to that point, you know, that all of our companies, cost is a real issue. So that they like that, you know, being able to pull in a service on a needs basis, not having the headache of having payroll. I mean, as they grow, it changes, you know. So for example, like Jenny was CFOing on a fractional basis for one of our companies. That company's now grown up and they've hired a, you know, full-time CFO. So being able to flex up and down for the companies is so important in that early, when you're not quite sure when your next capital raise is going to be, how much that's going to be. So trying to trim those costs and keep them managed, you know, it's working really well.
Yeah. What, aside from, I guess, you know, the lack of investment and the lack of dollars that have been out there, I think one of the other common complaints that I hear from founders when they're dealing with investors and VC has been that, you know, the advice that they've been given through this period has been fairly vanilla and generic. And it's almost like memes that, you know, oh, well, don't worry, great businesses are built in a downturn. Or, you know, you just got to get the cash flow positive. So it's kind of, it's
there's, not that how, easy how, always.
Right? Like how? So from you know, what is it about that kind of Scolari that, yeah, you're able to not just say to an investor, sorry, a founder, hey, you need to get the cash flow positive, but can you do the how and the when and the why as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We become part of the investing company's team. I think that's the essential differentiation here. So the example that Zhao shares, one of our investing companies, when we first invest, they had no finance functions, discipline, whatnot, right? The founders are doing the bank rec and everything else. So I jump in and I work 2 days a week.
Right.
So it's hand-on real solving problem, right? Mm. So working together with the founder and the team to win the first significant RFP, you know, reshape their financial model and, you know, really pushing, you know, the customer to pay. So it's real tangible deliverables that we are responsible and accountable for to help the founders to get through, you know, those early days.
Actually, I want to touch on that, Jenny, because one of the things that I've found in having worked in this space for close to a decade is there are these patterns that emerge, right, for businesses that go through the life cycle. And I want to talk particularly about the CFO because this has been a really interesting challenge, and it's one way I've, you know, advocated for using a fractional exec for, you know, since I started the business. When you start, you essentially need a bookkeeper, right? And somebody to go and help you raise capital. And they're two completely different people, right? And so usually what the a founder will do is they'll go, let's get somebody from an investment bank, corporate finance to help us raise capital. And accounts are an absolute mess, right? It's a basket case. They get the capital, you start to scale, and it's like, oh, we need to like get governance in our house in order. So, you know, the corporate finance dude, they're off. You bring in a financial controller style CFO, they fix everything. And then you start to get traction and success, and it's, oh, we're going to IPO now. Oh, we need the corporate finance investment banking CFO to make the ASX happy and investors happy, right? And you kind of go through the cycle of just like having to vacillate between these two different types of people. And it's been a real problem for businesses and has really stunted their ability to scale successfully. Do you see that as well?
I certainly see that, first of all. I think it's a common challenge in this space. How we overcome that challenge is, first of all, the founding partners and partners of Scolari, we are all operators. Like we've been through that journey before. Yeah. So as I mentioned, you know, I spent the last 15, 18 years working with early startups. So I've kind of been through the both side of the journey, right? And I think, you know, having someone who really, first of all, doesn't mind get our hands dirty. Like for me, there's nothing that is too small or nothing that is too big, right? If we need to raise 200 invoices to get that cash flow in, let's do it. If we need to speak you know, in front of an investor in the room and then just get that 2-3 million in. Let's do it. But this is not just a one person. This is not just a journey, right? Again, coming back to Scolari, one thing that we both feel very proud of is we build a very supportive community that connects founder with investor, with advisors, you know, like Giles, like myself, with, you know, NEDs. And if the business kind of goes through from, you know, that one stage to the next stage, we have in-house expertise like James, right? He's brilliant in listed environment.
Before Scolari, James was my go-to person for any client that said, we're looking to IPO, we need a CFO.
There you go.
And he's still that person. Absolutely.
And then we have, you know, Giles and Nick, who is also the other funding partners, who's really familiar and know all the tricks in the private market. So I feel like within the Scolari communities, we got, you know, 500-600 members as well around the globe who have, you know, past experience. So I feel like we are not just a big four or an investment bank, or, you know, we can actually go right deep in, but we can also step out and give that strategic input and view to kind of grow together with the investing companies when they go through different stages.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, you know, is that we've all raised money for our own companies. I mean, over the James, Nick, Jenny, I, we've all been there and seen and done it. I mean, when we started the business, capital was really easily available. You know, there was a lot of it. You know, it's not so easily available now, you know. So, you know, although we try and work with the companies as closely as possible, you know, we can't make promises. You know, it's as the story is the story, and the founder has to sell that story, and we will guide them through that process, and we'll help them with the investment brand, and we'll help them with all the preparation of it. And coming to your point, Dexter, you know, we'll work with them, start looking at the accounts first and sort of work systematically through it. But ultimately, the founder has to be, once we connect them with investor, they have to be able to sell the story, and we'll try and prep them as best we can to do that.
One thing that's really fascinated me is, you know, as we've seen the startup ecosystem evolve in Australia, has been that perhaps, you know, the places that we've gone to for inspiration and emulation have been the wrong places. You know, and I'm talking specifically Silicon Valley, you know, California, the fourth biggest economy in the world. Kind of doesn't make sense to me that having an economy of that size so concentrated and thinking that you can copy that and you're gonna have the same level of success, you know, would work. So where did the inspiration come from to try a completely different model to the one that everybody else was trying to emulate?
Well, I suppose I'll start this off, but, you know, we're not coming from the traditional sort of venture capital or finance background. That's not our background. We come from running tech businesses and all the rest of it. Where it came about from was 10 years ago, my old company entered a thing called the Australian Technologies Competition, which we won, and it was a fantastic experience for us. We went through this mentoring program. And after that, I was invited to be a judge. And so for the last 10 years, I've been a judge of this. And I saw loads and loads and loads of really good, cool technology out of Australia, emerging technology, all looking for the same two things, capital and help. And all of them were struggling. And the venture capital community in Australia seemed to be further downstream than it is in other countries and other parts of the world. So there's a real gap in sort of not only funding, but that support that happens at the early stage. And that's really what informed us to start Scolari 3.5 years ago, because we just go, we've got experience, you know, we've been seen and done it, we've always raised money, raised money in the public markets because there wasn't a lot of venture capital for what I was looking for at the time. We've all been seen and done at the rough and the smooth, and we've got experience that, and operationally had experience. So we figured that with our experience and Jenny's experience, that we could come together, help these companies from a capital point of view, but also help them, you know, grow, scale, look for further capital. And because there's no time-based limit in our capital deployment, you know, we're not a closed-end fund. We can be with them on the journey as long as it takes. And then we have the ability to sort of bring them out the other end. As you mentioned earlier, James is an IPO expert. You know, Nick is a trade sale expert. We can work with them all the way through their journey.
Coming back onto investors, it's often said, and I think felt, that Australian investment community kind of lacks any real risk appetite. And oftentimes, you know, kind of VC is almost looking at a business through the eyes that a private equity firm might. And unless you're in mining or property technology, we don't really tend to want to take a risk on. Is that necessarily true?
I think we start to see a bit of change, is our observation. Over the last couple of years, people focus more on the early stage tech business. The risk appetite become broader comparing to the good old days.
Yeah.
And we also see more collaborations in this space, in a sense of, you know, VC private equity investment firm like Scolari, we co-invest into the same opportunities or refer, you know, deal flow to each other. So we certainly see a lot more of those partnership, I suppose, you know, mode of operating than the kind of direct compete in the past. Yeah.
And Giles, going back to your point, I think, you know, if you look at the data, it kind of suggests that Australia is good at getting ideas and innovation off the ground, maybe is not so great at commercializing that and kind of, you know, making really successful businesses from that. What do you think we need to be doing differently? Because it seems to me like at the early stage, I don't think Australia needs another accelerator program. I don't think we need another kind of, you know, fintech or innovation hub.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because, you know, there's a lot of businesses that come with a great idea and they feel they can't commercialize it here, so they just disappear offshore, you know. And I suppose that's where we sort of try and step in, because I think, you know, if you can provide some of that early stage capital and the support, and I think the support is absolutely critical.
Yeah.
You can do that. And it's not just, you know, support and raising capital, but it's the sort of building your sales channels and things like that.
Yeah.
So there's always, I constantly see businesses that go, well, we must commercialize in the US. Well, why? Why do you have to go and commercialize? You've got a great sort of sounding board here in Australia. You can start experimenting going offshore, perhaps in New Zealand, or if you want to go to the US, try in Canada and work there. It's a softer market to go into. So providing that support for the commercialization, but, you know, using the experience we've got, you know, we've been doing this internationally for a long time. So we've all had experience of business internationally. But, you know, to your point, Dexter, it's really providing that earlier stage capital and support for the businesses and keeping them onshore and guiding them down that sort of path of commercialization.
Jenny, how frustrating is it when you kind of hear these kind of, you know, advice by memes of, you know, oh, you got to go to the US, right? And say, nobody asks why. It's just that's what you have to do. How frustrating is it to kind of see people under, you know, giving advice where it's actually probably the worst advice you can give somebody?
Yeah, to be honest, very frustrated, okay? people sometimes underestimate the amount of investment, and that's time and money, okay?
Yeah.
As well as opportunity costs, like rather than going, you know, all the way to US, UK, why not look at opportunities nearby, right?
Yeah.
So it actually costs a lot more than what people think to take the business that far away from home. I think, you know, coming back to the environment that we are in right now, if founders can really leverage their trusted advisors and mentor around them and just really, you know, listen to their story, the journey they've gone through, the mistake they've made, and just really explore, you know, just in the APAC area, right? Like it's sad to see we have really, really, you know, good business ideas here, you know, born in APAC, but, you know, but not really commercialized in this space. And I do feel that we have a lot more opportunities for founders here to explore.
It's a very good point, actually. I mean, Jenny's been a massive advocate of looking to the north of us, you know, to Singapore, to Asia, you know, for opportunities. There's huge amounts of opportunities. We were just talking about it today, that Singapore is a really good environment for commercialization and for tech development and things like that. So, you know, looking there perhaps first instead of looking to the US to take, you know, the US is such a fragmented place and very complicated to get into, whereas going through, going internationally, market expansion through, say, Singapore, it's probably a hell of a lot easier than sort of starting with the US. And Jenny, you know, that's been her mantra all along, you know, with the companies we're working with, and rightly so.
Yeah. One thing that's, well, it hasn't surprised me, but it has a bit within the kind of startup community, has been the number of rebrands and name changes that I've seen in the last 12 months and pivots. And I remember years back, one of my old bosses and mentors said at the time, in a downturn, there's two types of chief exec, one who changes the business and another who changes the logo. And, you know, what he meant by that was, hey, look, you know, kind of the real people, the real deal will come in and they'll change the business and turn it around. Others will just kind of focus on, you know, the low hanging fruit that doesn't really make a change. What's your, you know, kind of guidance around the what I call the dreaded pivot, because as soon as there's an economic downturn, again, you get people coming out saying you've got to pivot, you've got to change, you've got to, you know, go and change markets, change the logo, change the brand, all the, you know, all of this change. Is that necessarily the right thing to do, or is it sometimes just a case of just seeing out the storm?
Yeah, well, we pivot too many times and people lose patience. I've seen it. Certainly, I come from working in the public markets. You know, I was in a listed environment, and you see that, you know, with companies pivoting one too many times and investors just run out of patience and lose interest in it. So, you know, obviously, if it's not working what the company's doing, of course you need to change. But, you know, be very, very, think very carefully and, you know, look at the strategy before you make any major changes. You don't want to be doing it again and again, and then investors run out of patience.
Can that be just something where perhaps you just got the wrong channel, or, you know, it's not a case of changing the product, it's just a case of looking at a different market or customer?
I mean, like, for example, there's one of our companies which was really going down a B2C path and it just wasn't working. Yeah. So the product was fundamentally sound and just readjusted to a B2B model, and that's beginning to work really well for it, you know. So it wasn't a huge change, but it's just changing the focus on the customer.
Yeah.
And that's been really successful for them.
Yeah. And it doesn't cost much money to
that's right.
So, Jenny, I wanted to kind of go back to this cash word, right, and cash flow. Again, you know, kind of we talked about this where you get this kind of generic advice and, you know, kind of cut costs, you know, increase customers. We've got a lot of businesses out there, and look, unfortunately, I think in this next 12 months, from the discussions I'm having, I'd say probably 50% of the fintech community is going to go out of business if things don't kind of change in the next 12 months. Given that, you know, they might have a 12-month timeline, what are the kind of two or three things that you would be, if you were going in there today, say, we've got to do this today to make sure that we're here to fight, you know, in 12 months' time?
Yeah, first thing I look at is whether we have explored all the government grant opportunity. Right. Yeah, a lot of people kind of overlook that. Or we know they're out there, but it takes time and effort, right, to apply, and there's a chance that you might miss it. But evidence shows it's actually easier and likely to be successful than you now go out and trying to raise, you know, large amount of capital or win, you know, 10 new customers. So, because that's the first thing that I would look at, some housekeeping, right?
Yeah.
And secondly, is I will have a very thorough review of where we deploy fund right now. So just cost base. I'm not asking companies not to spend. That's not what I'm saying. But just really understand what is my return on investment for where and how much I choose to spend. I think just to reassess that, reevaluate that against the company's strategy and goal for the next 6 to 12 months is really important.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, again, I mentioned, you know, think about the creative alternative funding options out there, right? There are facilities, credit facilities, loan, you know, there are finance-based or revenue-based financing. Just really explore the options. And if you do have to raise, you know, consider maybe a smaller amount.
Yeah.
Right. Reduce the size, and then let's buy another 6 months.
Yeah.
Hit a few milestones, and let's go out again. So just be prepared of, you know, that kind of mindset. All we want is just get through this 12-month period, right? And then you have a chance of, you know, create something much bigger in the long run.
Just stretching that runway out and just maximizing what you have. Just, you know, because the uncertainty is the problem. You know. Obviously. Some companies, they can't get away from, they have to raise, but the timing is everything, you know, when you do that. So our advice to our companies at the moment is, like, you know, maximize your runway as long as you can at this moment in time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you have people under pressure, you do get some bad actors who take advantage. And there's some, you know, like, unfortunately, I've personally seen, you know, a lot of founders burnt by so-called advisors.
Oh God, I see it all the time. Yeah. So, you know, they go, oh, pay us a retainer of, you know, 10 grand a month and, you know, 6% success fee and we'll get you capital. And then there's no responsibility. I've seen it, unfortunately, way too many times.
So my kind of question to you, Giles, are what are the things that founders should be looking out for that are red flags so that they avoid this? Because, you know, these are the people that I say, if you're flying the plane and you're flying whilst you're building it, this person's going to crash you straight into the mountain.
Well, advice to them is, look, talk to us first, you know, let us work with them. We know who the bad actors are and we know how to manage it. Again, not naming any names, but one of our portfolio companies did exactly that. They had someone came in and they were just about to sign a contract. And I said, no, don't do it. You know, let me meet with them. And I found out that these people were not going to actually add any value, going to drain the dwindling resources, and it wasn't going to be a good outcome. So we're always saying to them, and this is part of, to Jenny's point, you know, the guidance we give our companies is work with us, we'll work with you, and we'll try and help you manage this. You know, our interest is not in the monies we make from capital raising. Our money, our interest is to making sure the companies are invested, they grow, and we're with them on that journey, you know. And the capital raise is just a something that we can support them with on that journey and try and avoid the pitfalls.
And I maybe add to that, this is probably more of a woman thing, trust your instinct, right? Sometimes if you don't have a good feeling, you talk to maybe a few more people just to sanity check that, right? So hence it's very important to surround yourself. Like people say that founder is a very lonely place, but just really surround yourself with your trusted advisor, and don't be afraid to say no, right?
Yeah.
If somebody charges you a 10K retainer and not delivering anything for, you don't even need to wait for 3 months, you know, it's just 1 month. If you're not happy with the outcome, sit down, have a very frank, open conversation and address it right and there. So I think, you know, just that, that ability to make that decision and allowing, empowering yourself to make that decision for your business is also very important.
Yeah, try and not get into any sort of contracts like that. But you're absolutely right. There are lots of people out there, bad actors who, you know, will promise the earth and deliver nothing and, you know, and consume valuable time for these businesses, which they don't have.
Yeah. Right. I want to raise the mood of the discussion now because, look, it has been a really challenging last 12 months. But these things do not last forever. And whilst I was kind of, you know, ringing the alarm bell, maybe it's 12, 18 months back in my business, I'm seeing the green shoots and I'm seeing, you know, international businesses look at Australia again. I'm seeing businesses, you know, looking at their structure and their executive structure and scaling and moving to the next level. And this has all been happening over the last, you know, 6 weeks. So I think we're starting to see now, and I think you'd mentioned as well, you're starting to sense there's a little difference in the mood of investors. So what are the, I guess, you know, what are you seeing from investors as to the things that, you know, the ideas, the, you know, the technologies, the, you know, the industries that they're really getting excited about that, you know, they want to invest in?
Look, you're absolutely right. The investors are looking to invest again. There's definitely interest again, where 12 months ago people were sitting on their hands and just wait and see. I can see that there is genuine interest. You know, we see so many companies from such a broad range of different, you know, industries. I think the stuff that investors are really interested in at the moment is stuff that, you know, making fundamental changes in this sort of society we're in. So circular economy, clean tech, green tech, all these sort of things are really interesting. But having said that, you know, the stuff that we've recently invested in has been ed tech. We've had some ag tech, you know, we've had some compliance businesses. I mean, it's a broad interest from our investors, but yeah, they're definitely beginning to have signs of, you know, re-engagement. People are looking now to write checks again, slowly but surely.
Yeah.
It's not a home and homes yet.
No, but we're talking about green shoots.
And another thing that I noticed investors are looking for these days is diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, Scolari, right? We have 26 companies across 6 different countries. And from a gender equity point of view, you know, 1 in every 3 to 4 companies is either led by a female founder or have a female kind of executive team. So I think that diverse and inclusive investment portfolio give the investor the confidence that in terms of, you know, chance of success and, you know, the pathway to profitability, like it really adds that extra comfort. So I encourage, you know, founders to think about that when they prepare their pitch deck, right? Like, not to make up stories, but just if you are doing well or if you are aware of this in your business, in your day-to-day practice, highlight that in your pitch deck. And I also encourage, you know, female founders and like business led by female executive team come out. Like, there are investors out there that are looking to support you. Scolari is definitely one of those.
But I mean, just the other thing to the other side of the coin is that, say, what are investors looking at? equally, you get floods of different themes, you know, where suddenly there's a whole lot of AI companies or Web3 companies and all the rest of it. It sort of comes in waves at such like, you know. But, you know, I think, again, it's a diverse portfolio. We're seeing such a broad range of different businesses. A lot of it for us is mainly software rather than hardware.
I think we talked about the pivot before, and I think one of the real dangers about the pivot now is these hype cycles are getting shorter and shorter. I mean, we're already over the AI one, I think. Yeah. It was, what, 6 months? Yeah. It's over with. So if you're going to kind of go to that effort of trying to ride the next wave, you've got to time it 3 or 4 waves ahead, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's probably less about like what's popular. I think founders need to be very mindful of the purpose of why I build this business from the get-go, right? I think it's that impact and stay very true and honest about that impact, because the wave comes and goes, right? Yep. So coming back to fintech, again, our portfolio, it's quite diverse in the sense that we cover 10 different verticals, but fintech, we have a few companies that kind of fits in that industry. Even that industry itself, we have company that looked at, you know, cross-border payment. We have company that look at, you know, corporate credit cards and expense control, company that look at, you know, smarter compliance and risk mitigation solutions. So even within the fintech itself, it's quite diverse in a sense that, you know, it covers from A to Z. So that itself creates opportunity for, you know, upsells and cross-sells, right?
Absolutely.
So that's important.
I mean, Giles, you talked about, I think, 5 different, you know, kind of themes there. Ag tech, ed tech, clean tech.
Yeah.
I've got people, customers in my network that are all in those spaces, right? Because
send them our way,
right? They will, but they all need. Everybody needs finance, right? To make these operate. They need, they're highly regulated. They need compliance solutions, right? So, and I think it's this kind of lateral thinking. And one thing that really I want to talk about more is when you talk about diversity, Jenny, because I've got no science to back this up, right? But I think it's something that's worth talking about. When you look at diverse businesses and unilaterally, they perform better, right? And I do wonder if the reason that they perform better isn't necessarily because of the diversity. The diversity is the byproduct of open-minded leadership that's inclusive, that focuses on getting the right people, the best people, right?
I certainly agree. It's more of a mindset thing. I think that diversity and inclusion is actually the outcome of that of that mindset.
Yeah,
you need to have that mindset first to welcome and then practice drive, and then you see the result, right? Again, I can't really speak on behalf of other you know, key players in the market, but coming back to Scolari, just amongst our core team, we actually have people coming from 6 or 7 different cultural backgrounds.
Yeah.
And our, you know, gender diversity is pretty much about 50-50.
Yeah.
So I think just looking at how we operate, like every week when our IC team come together, we welcome different perspective. We have, you know, healthy discussion and debate sometimes. And I think coming back to your point about how would that link to the business performance and profitability, we certainly feel the direct impact. And we also see that from the companies that we invest as well, right?
Yeah.
We introduce, you know, female NED, we introduce, you know, executive team from different cultural backgrounds, and we start to see over time the dynamic, the chemistry change and then lead to business success. So we've seen that a couple of times within our examples.
It's fair to say that, you know, some companies have come to us that we invested in who have been out in the big world of VC and got really intimidated by it, because it is quite an overwhelming place.
Yeah.
They come to us and they, you know, they speak to someone like a Jenny, and they you know, who really understands and listens to them, and, you know, they find it a much more comfortable environment to work in, you know.
Funny, I had a chat with somebody just this morning, and, you know, they're a really successful founder. And what was interesting was this founder said that when he was, the VC approached him actually and said, we need you to do a psychometric test. And he went, no. Said, that to me sounds like a master-servant relationship, and I'm looking for a partnership.
But that point about partnership, that is absolutely critical. You know, it's not us and them. We're working together.
Yeah.
We're their engine room to try and get them successful. And it's a partnership. It has to be a partnership.
Yeah.
It's the only way it works.
Right. Here's the question for you, Jenny. You've got $10 million. Where do you put it right now?
in terms of investment industries, personally, I love the business that creates direct impact, do good things to our community. So I'm more thinking about, you know, those clean energy technology, those that really, you know, increase our social responsibilities, not necessarily just measuring, you know, the ESG report, but just really, you know, I suppose bringing that positive governance and social responsibility impact to our communities. Mm. Like that would probably be the thing that is most close to my heart.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say, I share those thoughts entirely. I mean, that's the technologies competition I met earlier. I mentioned earlier on was used to be called the clean tech competition, and that's, you know, unfortunately, at the time, there wasn't a lot of love for clean tech, or there is now. But, you know, I think anything that improves the environment that we live in is you know, very important. But equally, a business where, you know, if we're going to invest $10 million, we want a business that's got growth potential beyond these borders, you know, has got real opportunities to scale outside of Australia and become a global business. That's what we're interested in. You know, if it fits those sort of industries that we like, even better. But another point to all of this is, we only invest in companies where we can genuinely add value. We understand the industry, or we have someone in our community who can plug into that industry. If we don't understand it, you know, pharma, et cetera, we're not going to, you know, participate. We're not going to be able to add the value. Mm. But it's got to be somewhere add value, but, you know, something we're also passionate about as well.
Yeah. So we're coming to a wrap up. Before we do, we get, you know, we've got incredible founders listen to this podcast. We also have incredible talent as well. And I'm sure many of them are contemplating you know, career as perhaps a fractional exec, as perhaps wanting to make a move into, you know, this type of business model and environment. First of all, on the you know, kind of talent side, what would you look for people that you were potentially bringing into the business as you grow and scale?
Well, we see a lot of people, and not all of them are suited for what we do, but we're looking for someone who's got, you know, transferable skills and a genuine interest and passion in the startup world. That's it. You know, and they really can sort of roll up the sleeves and are not afraid to get their hands dirty. So we've built up a really good sort of network of people who will sort of fall into that advisor category. And some of them actually then go on to be a non-executive director for us, you know, as a Scolari representative of these companies. But it's people who genuinely love that sort of scale up startup and can, you know, translate their skills into it.
And Jenny, from a founder perspective, you know, if we've got, you know, people that are potentially looking at partners and investors, what are the some of the criteria that you kind of want to see if people are reaching out to you?
We always talk about smart money, right? So capital plus plus. But I think the real differentiation here is people really do what they say they do. And sometimes it's really hard to kind of get that from one or two meetings if you just happen to know someone, you know. So I think one thing that I would encourage founder to do is, you know, first of all, leverage your DNA, right? Leverage your network around you. Could be other founders that you know or your existing investor on your cap table who share similar interests. Ask them whether they can make some intro, right? Because it might be what you need to look for is like-minded investor. Yeah. And there's no one size for all answer, you know, but whatever matters to you, you know, founder of company ABC, what like-minded means is for you to really go out and hunt for that. So when we say capital raise journey, usually starts 6 months before you even start to put your deck together, because you need to look around and see the community and network around you and start to target, you know, these are the top three or five people that I think is like-minded, who can provide that smart capital, who will do what they say they will do. Yeah. You have all that due diligence almost done up front.
You know, it's amazing advice, right? And I've been doing a lot of stuff on LinkedIn around job hunting.
Yeah.
And I've been giving exactly the same advice for job hunting. And I think what people do is, whether it's raising capital or it's looking for a new job, they do stuff that is, if you look at the sales funnel, the 95% of stuff that's heavy activity driven, very little result.
Mm.
And the ones who are successful spend 95% of their time on the 5% of the activities that actually get results, which is networking, research, clear value proposition, talking to the right people, asking for help, doing it in a way where it makes it easy for people to help.
Yeah.
Not asking for an hour of time, but 5 minutes. Or, hey, can I ask you one question? Like this stuff is you know, they kind of differentiate those who are successful and those who aren't.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And look, you're talking about using that network. We've got this fantastic network at Scolari, and we leverage that as much as possible, particularly for sort of companies that are trying to grow their sales, are trying to get their first 10 customers on board. And rather than just going through a volume spray, it's much better to get a warm introduction from the Scolari network and sort of be, you know, get a position in there. It's so much easier and leverage that network. And so we're really, really keen to make the most of that network all the time with our companies.
Yeah, I think it's important as well to the moment that we're in. I think it's fair to say founders are feeling pretty unloved right now.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's that saying, if you want to go fast, go along. If you want to go far, go together. And I think we're kind of being reminded of that now, that actually, you know, the power of networks, the power of, you know, not just collaboration, but partnerships is kind of essential, and particularly in the Australian market where there just isn't the, you know, I guess the kind of safety net of large capital, large population, where you can make a lot of mistakes and still find a path to success.
One thing I just want to add, just to balance that point a little bit, trust is one thing that is critical, but I also see some founders, they become too trusting and then they need to pay for that. So for example, you know, when we go through the entire funding journey, at the end, you got someone to give you the capital, you know, exciting, awesome moment. You sign whatever term sheet and just get that money, right? But just be very mindful of the actual term and condition of the term sheet, right? Yeah. Like, don't just go too trusting. Yeah. You do need to look at whether there's any special rights. And also try to avoid just relying on one single investor, because sometimes, you know, through that trusting relationship, this is always the same person that give you money. But coming back to the point that sometimes founders feel that they got advantage by others, like that's because if you only have one single investor, that person have a lot more negotiating power, right, or direct influence to your business. So trying to also build a diverse investor portfolio as well.
So just like you need a diverse customer portfolio, you need a diverse investor portfolio.
But to your point is there's smart money as well. So building a cap table of people who understand what you want and can help you along the way. It's not just, you know, dumb money. It's money that's going to really support you. The people who can open doors, the network that open doors. You know, that's what we always try. When we're working with our portfolio and they're looking for capital, we try and find people who, you know, match the right type of investors. Yeah. Easier said than done now, but it, you know, in the past, that was what we did. Obviously, things will improve in the future.
Yeah, brilliant. Where can people find out more about Scolari Partners?
Oh, well, we have a website which has all the resources. And so what we do for all of our companies is we have a sort of really good database of resources on how to raise capital, how to access customers. And we have that all on our website, so accessible by all of our founders. But Scolari.com, that's where we're located. And I will just add, sorry, one other point, Dexter, because it's important for the startup community. I mentioned earlier on where we were involved with the Australian Technologies Competition. We're running that competition now to foster sort of up-and-coming innovation in Australia. It's been so good to my company 10 years ago, and you know, I've seen so many good things that we've taken over the operations of that, and it's supported by federal and state government money. And we're just coming to the end of the competition right now, so we're having sort of finalist judging tomorrow. And then we have two gala events, one on the 12th of September in Melbourne and one on the 28th of September in Sydney. And we really encourage people from the sort of startup community or the whole ecosystem come along to that, because you'll see some really good companies, good chance to network and mingle with the sort of startup communities.
We'll put a link in the show notes to that. Well, folks, thanks for listening. As always, you can connect with me on LinkedIn and Twitter. If you're new to the show, make sure to give us a follow. It really helps me not only spread, I guess, you know, the good word to the startup ecosystem, but it also helps in us getting great guests on like Giles and Jenny. Until the next episode, keep well.
FinTech Chatter is produced by Tier 1 People, leaders in FinTech executive search. We'll find world-class leadership talent to build world-class FinTech ventures, and you can find us at tier1people.com.